There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
Right, 107 FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along and another hour of live local talk. And phone number, text line open for you, 343-0106. Also a reminder, the brand new FM Talk 106.5 app waiting for you. If you go to, if you're an iPhone user, not to start last hour's conversation again, but iPhone user, you can grab it from the App Store. If you're an Android user, Google Play, just search for FM TALK 1065. See our logo, and that's the app, and you'll be ready to go. So download it and tell us what you think about it. All right, I mentioned this with Jeff last hour, that our guest this hour to join us to talk about Guantanamo and the kind of maybe the question about how I got on this subject. So it's something I paid attention to for a while, but it was over the last month and a half when we saw the leadership of the Taliban return there in Kabul. And many of the, three of four of them, I think, that were kind of the top leaders of the Taliban were people we had had at Guantanamo Bay, the United States had had at Gitmo. And it got me thinking more about how little I know about Guantanamo Bay and why we're there. So it's lucky that I found Dr. Stephen Schwab, who has written the book, Guantanamo USA. And is joining us now to talk more about this book and a life that is very, very interesting. A man that has spent time working in Latin America for our country through the Central Intelligence Agency and 32 years working mainly as a political analyst on Latin American issues. And the man qualified to write a book that is education we all need. Dr. Stephen Schwab, thanks for your time. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So I got to let's back up here before we even get into writing this book, and I'll ask you the question I'm sure you've heard so many times: why'd you write a book about Guantanamo? But before that, what a story from the world of the Central Intelligence Agency to also being a professor. Can you walk us through that?
Sure. Well, I joined the CIA a long time ago at the end of the Lyndon Johnson administration in 1967. And what happened was I had been doing some academic study in Mexico, and I came back to the United States, and when I walked into my mother's home in Springfield, Missouri, she said there was a very polite gentleman who was calling every day, but he wouldn't give her his name. But he wanted very much to get in touch with me. So I called him, and, he was a CIA recruiter. At that time, we had actual recruiters all over the United States in major cities, and we don't have that anymore. Anyway, so I thought I was going to be drafted and go to Vietnam. Because it was 1967, but,
right.
So anyway, I wasn't drafted. I don't think the fact that I applied to CIA had anything to do with that, but, anyhow, I joined the agency in the summer, of 1967 and, was an analyst, a current intelligence analyst working on Latin American issues. Writing for intelligence publications, including something called the President's Daily Brief that goes to the President and the Vice President and the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, maybe the Secretary of the Treasury, a National Security Advisor, and anybody else the White House designates, and also writing for a slightly lower-level publication. These publications are published 6 days a week. And so I did that for a long time. And then in 1995, I was assigned as the CIA representative or advisor to Maxwell Air Force Base, where I basically taught classes and on intelligence and some other things. And then I got in touch with a Latin Americanist who was on the faculty of the history department here at the University of Alabama. And he knew I didn't have my PhD, so he said, well, you probably have enough time in to have a decent retirement. Why don't you come down to Tuscaloosa and get your PhD and teach for a second career? So, well, that was the best idea I had. That's what I did.
I hate that I missed you by 6 years. I'd love to have been in your class, that's for sure. But what a career. I would have... And I do want to get into Guantanamo, but thinking about Latin America, obviously you're putting these reports out. So much was going on in Latin America, you know, in the battle, the proxy war, Cold War that was going on there. At the same time, you had we're only talking about 5 or 6 years after the Bay of Pigs invasion, right? That you're right, going to work for CIA. How does that color what you do for your reports? I mean, how much of your reports were Cuba versus other places in Latin America?
Well, actually, I didn't work on Cuba when I was in the agency. I worked on virtually everything but. I guess towards the end of my analytical career, I became a regional Latin American analyst. So Cuba sometimes was something I wrote about. But I started off working on South American countries and writing for senior publications, including the President's Daily Brief and the National Intelligence Daily, and the nice thing about that was that in the editorial process, you know, I'd write a piece and it would go to my branch chief, and it would then go to the division chief, and then it would go upstairs to the publications staffs. There were two publications that I wrote for, one called the National Intelligence Daily, and sometimes articles from that were picked up by the President's Daily Brief, which is only about 6 pages long. So it had to be fairly important to make it into the President's Daily Brief. But the nice thing about that was that at every editorial level, they would all, whoever was editing my stuff, would come back to me and say, did we put in the most important things that you wanted in there? And do you have any problems with editorial changes? If so, let us know. And so basically, I had a considerable amount of control over what I wrote until it actually was published and went to the President's Daily Brief goes to about 6 people, the President, the Vice President, Secretary of State, Secretary of the Treasury, and National Security Advisor, and anybody else who the White House designates. So that's what I did for a long time. And then in 1995, I was assigned as the CIA rep to Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery, Alabama. That's how I came to Alabama and did that for 5 years. And then I had become friends with a professor in the history department who said, well, why don't you come down here and get your PhD and teach? So that's what I did.
Like it. So this puts me at the easy pivot point for that cliched question. So Dr. Stephen Schwab, why'd you write a book on Guantanamo? Out of all the things you had looked at, why are we talking about Guantanamo with your book?
Well, because we it's the place in Cuba where we went in 1898 and with the Marines, and we've been there ever since. And so I'm sure the Cubans would like for us to get out, but we're still there. And so I thought it would be interesting to go back to the beginning about looking at the Marine invasion of Gitmo during the when we came in at the tail end of the Spanish-American War and sort of made it our war, and then stayed on. General Leonard Wood sort of established a military U.S. military government there, and then withdrew. I think it was around 1903, but we continued to intervene in Cuban affairs largely through sending Marines into Gitmo or whatever. Up until 1933, and that was when Franklin Roosevelt terminated the Platt Amendment, under which we had been intervening, but we still retained the right not only to have Guantanamo, but basically to use that base, which is still under U.S. control. And so I wrote about the base. I didn't write about the prison.
Gotcha.
I mean, towards the tail end of what I wrote, of course, by that time the prison existed. But right. That wasn't the focus of what I was doing. I did, of course, deal with that. That really wasn't the main subject.
And I want to talk about that. Let's and chronologically, as is always good in history, although we could jump around. You mentioned this. I mean, this is probably unknown to a lot of Americans. Here you got the Spanish-American War, right? And we were involved. Weren't we like nearby? We're bombarding Santiago or something like that. And then
the Marines came into Guantanamo. We sent a Navy fleet around into the south part of Cuba, the Marines took Guantanamo. It was a Marine regiment that had been drilling. The Marines were on the verge of possibly going out of existence back then, and this gave them a new lease on life. And it was important in that sense.
We took it. It was true. Was it true what we would picture Marines, you know, in the old idea that they would leaving the U.S. Navy fleet ships and then going on to land and I guess fighting the Spanish there to take that land? Or were we opposed there, or did we just go in and take it as a beachhead? What was that like?
We were really largely unopposed. We just went in and secured that bay, and then we kept it because, from Gitmo is positioned at a place where it overlooks the Florida Strait and the nearby Atlantic Ocean, so you can deploy out of Guantanamo, or you could, to other parts of Latin America. And that, of course, was before we built the Panama Canal, which was done by Teddy Roosevelt's administration. And of course, that made it much easier for U.S. naval ships to go from Chilean side of South America, the western coast of Latin America, or South America and Mexico, for that matter, through the isthmus, rather than sail all the way down around the Cape on the Chilean side, and then come up via Brazil, Argentina, Brazil, and so on into the so go from the Pacific into the Atlantic. So that was significant. But anyhow.
Well, and we're going to run to the news break and come right back. I want to talk about this as we go from how we got our first feet on Guantanamo to the process that we're still there today. And I can't wait to hear about the lease agreement we have for that property as well. The man who wrote the book about it, Dr. Stephen Schwab, our guest right here on Midday Mobile. Be right back.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Yeah. Our guest, Dr. Stephen Schwab, and the book, Guantanamo, USA, The Untold History of America's Cuban Outpost. Dr. Schwab, we talked about kind of how the Marines first got their feet there at Guantanamo Bay and the beachhead. But soon, right, Cuba was the responsibility of the United States with a protectorate. Exactly how'd that work?
We established a protectorate to a great extent under something called the Platt Amendment. And the Marines took Guantanamo in 1898, and in August, I think it was, of 1898. And have had it ever since. And can do things in Guantanamo that we can't do in the United States as far as prisoners are concerned.
Yeah, can you kind of explain that to us? I mean, from the man that wrote the history of Guantanamo to your time with the agency, is there a kind of a quick version of why that's important? We talked about that during the war on terror, the value of Guantanamo. What is it? What is the thing that makes that valuable?
Makes Guantanamo valuable?
Yes, or somewhere we can take people outside the United States.
Yes. In my view, it's unfortunate, but mm-hmm. we can do things at Guantanamo that really would be very difficult for us to do in the United States, like waterboard people who we suspect of being terrorists, possibly do other things as well that are to try to get people who we think are dangerous and have information that if we got it might save American lives. But it's that's a highly controversial area.
It is, but I just wonder on the getting out of that part of it and just look at the mechanics of it. I agree that's a valuable discussion, but the mechanics of it, is it that because it is, and I want you to get into this lease agreement thing, that it's not it's lease soil. Like, we couldn't go to some holding we have in Micronesia, right, or Puerto Rico,
right,
for example, and do these things because that's U.S. land. There's something about this nature that, yeah, we have a base there, but it's not U.S. territory. I mean, can you explain that a little more? I want to tell you what, we're going to go to the news break and come back and have more of that conversation because I think that's interesting. People will say, well, we can just do it because it's outside our shores, but, you know, we couldn't do it in Puerto Rico. We'll have Dr. Schwab explain more of that when we come back.
Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
135 FM Talk 106.5. Midday Mobile. Glad to have y'all along. Continue our conversation with Dr. Stephen Schwab about Guantanamo, USA, the book. I'm looking, several of y'all spent time at Guantanamo. And Jace says here, Gitmo is one of the worst duty stations available. Not allowed to leave base. No civilian cell towers. Base rules are enforced almost draconianly and get sent to a Caribbean paradise, and you only get to look at it through chain link razor wire and an active minefield. So there's a description, Dr. Schwab, of what it's like to be there and be on the clock, right? Be working there.
Right.
Talk about how we got there. So this situation where we have – it is – the property that whatever it is, 100 – I don't know how big it is. What is the actual size of Guantanamo? Is it
– I forget exactly how many acres it is, but it's a fairly large compound, and it's, of course, right on the edge of this gorgeous bay. You can stand at the water's edge, and you can't, with your naked eyes, you can't actually see the whole width of the bay. You
okay.
have to kind of turn in sort of about three different directions to see the whole expanse of the bay. And that's why it was a place where the whole, for many, many years, the whole U.S. fleet could winter at Guantanamo. Could go down there, and so it's you know, it's been controversial from time to time, and then people kind of forget about it for a while.
Sure, yeah, then it comes back in. But so, and when we went to the break, this idea that. That the land is leased, right? Am I using the right term? It is not U.S. territory. It's something that we're renting.
Well, ever since the Castros came in 1959, even though we have paid a rental check, and I think we may still be paying it, the Cubans may have cashed the first check by accident, but I don't think they've cashed any other checks because they really don't want to acknowledge that there is a rental agreement. That was
so. Wait a second.
True under Fidel and Raul, and I don't think the current government's gonna cash any checks either.
So we do. We do send them. So at some point, and if we're still doing it, but for the Castro is in control. Here we have communist Cuba, and we're sitting down with the old checkbook there, the U.S. Treasury checkbook, and cutting them a check and sending it down to pay our yearly lease of the property, and they're not cashing it. But we went through that motion.
Right. Yeah. They don't want to acknowledge. In any formal way, that there is a rental agreement. No. Actually, I think if the current Biden administration wanted to significantly improve relations with Cuba, it would negotiate to give Guantanamo back. But I don't see that happening anytime soon.
But it's not. Go ahead.
I don't think there have been any moves in that direction. It might be a politically costly move for any U.S. president to do that. So I just, I don't know. But I think that's it would upset some. People in Florida and New Jersey, particularly Cubans who are exiles who still don't really like the current government in Havana.
Well, that's an understatement, especially after what happened here recently. But that's a whole other discussion of it. But it is interesting. I want people to know. So you say, so we don't, because people look at Guantanamo and say, well, that's, That was American land. We gained it in Spanish American War. We held on to it, but in fact, we're not. We're renting the property. They're not taking the money. I don't know. They don't think they can evict us. So I don't know. We're there for some time in the future. If we look at the, is there anything analogous to this in your research where we have a beachhead or just a footprint somewhere that we're basically renting space somewhere else in the world. Because I think about other protectorates and places, but those are that's U.S. territory. This is not. Is there another something like Guantanamo on the planet?
Not that I'm aware of, and that in the sense that you just described. No, I don't think so.
It's interesting.
And, for a long time we didn't call ourselves. I don't think we've ever really called ourselves an imperialist nation, but I would argue that that's exactly what we became in the late 19th century. Both in the Pacific, when we began by taking the Hawaiian Islands, and then we took other islands, in an era where there wasn't a lot of criticism of the U.S. government for doing that, and then of course we intervened in the Spanish-American War, both in the Pacific and in Cuba, and we took Guantanamo. The Marines took it, and we've been there ever since. And we, you know, when the so-called war on terror began, we could do things at Guantanamo, like waterboard people who we suspected of holding important information that was possibly dangerous to U.S. citizens, it's an area where we can do that sort of thing, and cases won't be brought into the U.S. Supreme Court about it. My own personal view is that that's certainly subject to criticism, but I'm not going to go there right now.
Do you think, Dr. Schraub, do you think that that's the top value as you look at, you know, because you're asking this question about would a president decide to let the, just move out, quit banking the rent payments that they're not cashing, but beyond that, is it in today's world where technology is obviously different than it was, you know, in the 1930s, 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s? The value of Guantanamo strategically, let's take out Camp X-Ray. Let's take that out for a second. Talk about the strategy there. Is it not as valuable, more valuable, equally as valuable as it was in 68?
Well, I don't know. I think you'd have to ask a senior official in the U.S. Navy a question like that, and you'd probably get a much better answer than you'd get from me. I think it's obviously a useful place. We've conducted shakedown cruises for new ships that we've put into our Navy out of Guantanamo. We've used it for various naval purposes. It's a lot more than an interrogation / possibly torture place. I don't know where to go from there.
Well, I think the best thing here is people want to read more about this. The book is out there. The best way for somebody to pick up a copy of Guantanamo USA, The Untold History of America's Cuban Outpost. How do they find the book?
Well, you can find it on Amazon, certainly. You can order it through your local bookstore. If enough people order it, I might get a small check from the University of Kansas Press.
Good.
Published it. The best thing to do, I think, would be to go online and order it via Amazon. I don't imagine many bookshops still have it, except used bookstores may carry it.
Hey, watch your numbers come up. Listen, with this audience, watch the numbers of the book come up, and then it'll be it'll be back into bookstores near everybody. So let's
that'd be great.
We'll do that. Dr. Schwab, I appreciate your time. Thanks for being on the show with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
There he is, Dr. Stephen Schwab, our guest at Guantanamo, USA, the untold history of America's Cuban outpost. All right, so check that out. I can link it up. I'll put it on the Twitter feed. Yeah, I can do that. Let me pop it up there on the Twitter feed. Y'all can check it out right there. Be right back. Give me a second here. News is next.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, at 150, the segment of the show brought to you by Stamps.com. So we're Stamps.com customer here at Bigler Broadcasting, FM Talk 106.5. I think we fit the definition of the small business that needs Stamps.com. Okay, we fit the definition of the any business that needs Stamps.com. If you don't want to be out getting stamps, going through that hassle, and actually doing that thing you do, whatever widgets y'all make or services you provide, do it with Stamps.com. Get the best use of your time. Simply use your computer to print official U.S. postage 24/7, any letter, any package, any class of mail, anywhere you want to send it. And once your mail is ready, just schedule a pickup or drop it off, like in the mailbox like I do here. It's that simple. And with Stamps.com, you'll get discounts of up to 40% off post office rates and up to 66% off UPS shipping rates. So no matter what you're doing, you're saving time and saving money. And then, you know, that's a good thing. Whatever business you're in, that's a good bottom line move. Stamps.com, a no-brainer. Saves you time and money. And you can stop wasting time right now going to the post office and do like us and go to Stamps.com instead. There is no risk. And with my promo code Sean, my first name, Sean, you'll get a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a digital scale, no long-term commitments or contracts. So just go to stamps.com, click on the microphone up there on the top of the homepage and type in Sean, S-E-A-N. I spell it the fast way. Stamps.com, promo code Sean, stamps.com. Never go to the post office again. Right, and but put that link up on the Twitter feed. I guess Twitter's still up. Yeah, it wasn't their day to get in trouble. Okay. Yeah, it's still up. So I put the link up to Dr. Schwab's book about Guantanamo. It's cool. You get in the details there of the early days of Guantanamo from the Marines. How about that? Marines taking that, Spanish-American War, coming in, you know, taking hold of that, and we're still there today. And the part of it, I think, the nuanced part that gets lost on a lot of people in the discussion about Gitmo, I guess, is the fact that, we don't own it. Like, we can have a discussion whether we should do, but we couldn't do things in interrogation, like if we're in Puerto Rico or Wake Island or somewhere like that, but we can do them Guantanamo because it's not U.S. soil. It's a place we rent. It's a rental place. So it's not timeshare, but it's like a long-term condo rental. All right. Let's get some calls here at 343-0106. And Tyler is in Mobile up first. Hey, Tyler.
Hey, Sean. Hey, I just wanted to talk to you, see if you heard the article or read the article about, the trillion-dollar coin that Janet Yellen said is, you know, no problem for us to make. I didn't even know I didn't know that was something that we did.
Well, when I saw the story, really like 30 minutes ago, yeah, Axios had it.
Drudge Report.
Yeah, and I wanted to go call at that point Angelo at Mobile Bay Coins and Fine Jewelry and say, hey, man, what do you got? So $1 trillion. So what Tyler's talking about, y'all, is $1 trillion platinum coin that could be minted, quote, within hours of the Treasury Secretary's decision to do so. $1 trillion coin here.
Well, you know, I wonder, like, do they put it in Fort Knox? Is if you steal it, can you cash it in? I mean, how does that work? And
they may be onto you. No, this is, that's I've right. had this trillion-dollar coin for a long time. What are y'all talking about? But what does it say?
She said, yeah, we can change the die and we can make a new die in 10 minutes or whatever.
Okay, listen, Tyler, help me with this. You and I can talk about it. If I go, let me tell you, by the way, side note, I was the only kid at my school not let into Art 2. Okay, they could teach anybody to draw. I didn't make it into Art 2. Art 1, they said, that's enough. You need to go to weight room or study hall or something. So if I get a piece of canvas and paint something on it, right, paint something, and I say, that's a Rembrandt. It's not a Rembrandt. And I mean, we got to ask this question. If we mint this $1 trillion coin, are we just fooling ourselves anymore? I mean, who are we fooling?
It's so funny that the conversation is even had. You know, they'll put it on a helicopter and drop it in the Treasury. It's like, at this point, quit it. It's like, get out of here. Make it out of steel. Come on.
Right, because it's not exactly make it out because it's just a symbol. It really doesn't back up.
Or more appropriately, make it out of blood. Golly, that's what it's going to take to pay back.
Make it out of grandchildren. Horrible to say. Let's make it out of grandchildren. Tyler, appreciate the call. Thank you, man.
Nice talking to you. You too. Bye-bye.
All right. I'll tell you what, we'll put this story up on the Twitter feed, too. I can do this in two clicks while I'm talking, and it's gone. What Tyler's talking about there is this, here it is. $1 trillion platinum coin could be minted within hours of the Treasury Secretary to do so. Decision to do so, said Philip Deal, former director of the U.S. Mint. Congressional solutions to the debt ceiling problem could take weeks to implement, especially if the reconciliation process is used. And time is running out. You're damn right it is. In case of an emergency, a $1 trillion coin could be deployed to bridge any gap between money running out and the debt ceiling being raised. Like Tyler said, we're living in silly land here. The U.S. Mint, which Deal ran from 1994 to 2000, already produces the 1 ounce Platinum Eagle that has no shortage of platinum blanks ready in stock. Producing a $1 trillion Eagle would require only the denomination to be changed. It could, like Tyler was saying, it could be quickly executed on the existing plaster mold of the Platinum Eagle. Dalton, can you get Angelo on the phone? We got to get him on this. Maybe tomorrow's show, we get Angelo to talk about this. Then an automated process would transfer the new design to a plastic resin mold. Okay, that's fine. Make it but what's its value? It goes on to say, even if Janet Yellen, Treasury Secretary, has no intention of minting such a coin, there is no reason for her not to quietly instruct the Mint director to take those steps a day or two in advance. At that point, a coin could be struck in minutes at the West Point Mint, even if then needed to be physically deposited at the New York Fed. That's the only a short helicopter ride away. Are we missing the, are they missing, of course they're missing the point. Of course they're missing the point. That we can strike a coin. So this is the thing. So if we need some more money, and we talk about printing money all the time, right? But this is emblematic. This is the hood ornament of that problem. Of fiat currency and fiscal. And I understand the dangers of leaving the American currency right now and jumping to something else, what it could do to our economy. I get that. But they're saying, once again, that they could, this would be the plan, that if they get in a pickle here between the debt ceiling being raised and our debts due, we just show them the $1 trillion coin and everything's good. We've lost our mind. We have truly, I mean, it says right here, this is a paragraph on Axios, congressional solutions to the debt ceiling problem could take weeks to implement, especially if the reconciliation process is used and time is running out. In case of emergency, yes, we should have it in a glass case that you can break it, right? You know, go up there with the little metal bar, break the glass, or reach in there and grab you the $1 trillion coin. It could be deployed to bridge any gap between the money running out and the debt ceiling being raised. If the money, does the money ever run out? We're going to run out of time because Feinbaum's on the second here. We can talk about it later on in the week. Does the money in fiat currency, does the money ever run out? It doesn't. What does it do? It inflates, correct, what we're seeing right now. But does it run out? No, you keep printing it. But what it's equal to, watch, you know what else you could always watch? And I think I've been told this at the dinner table since I was a little boy by my parents. They'd say, watch oil, Sean. Watch oil, and you talk about it. Because oil, there's a standard of what, how many of those things, those pieces of paper equal how much energy, right? Or oil. Look at what oil prices did today. I think we're up to, what, 77 a barrel? I think that was that Brent? Oil prices. Y'all go Google it. Let's see. Yeah, so Brent crude, $82.68. What didn't it get down to? Didn't it get down to less than zero early in former President Trump's time? Wasn't it less than zero? Okay, all right. We'll see you tomorrow.